Building any software, including web apps and APIs, requires testing, of course. There's automated testing, and there's manual testing. And in between, there's exploratory testing that's aided by automation tools. Michael Kennedy joins the show this week to share some of the tools he uses during development and maintenance. We talk about tools used for semi-automated exploratory testing. We also talk about some of the other tools and techniques he uses to keep TalkPython training, TalkPython, and Python Bytes all up and running smoothly. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions. And that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. On today's episode of Test and Code, Michael Kennedy joins me. Michael Kennedy, of course, is my co-host on Python Bytes and also runs his own podcast, Talk Python to Me. And he's got a little bit of an empire going on with Talk Python training and all sorts of stuff that Michael's up to. So, Michael, welcome.
Hey, Brian. It's really great to be on your show. Normally we get together on Python Bytes, and sometimes you're on Talk Python as well. So it's great to be over here at Test and Code.
Yeah. So, and it's wonderful to have you. One of the things, I don't really deal with websites as much as you do. I thought it'd be fun to talk about how to test websites and how to keep them, not just websites, but web services and different things and how to keep them running.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think there's a lot of stuff that is, you know, you hear about the straight down the line. These are the way you write your tests for websites, but there's all these other things that you got to do to build and develop and sort of test them as you're creating them before you can put them out in production, before you actually have a client to talk to it and things like that. So I thought it'd be fun to touch on some of those ideas that kind of round out the testing story of web apps.
Yeah, so take it away.
All right. Well, the first thing that I wanted to talk about, you know, if you're building a web application, you know, that does HTML that's intended for humans, it's pretty easy to get started and look at it. Right, you fire up your browser, you click the little link when you launch the app. It says your app is running at localhost, pulling 5,000 or whatever. And you click on it and you click around, and that's pretty straightforward. But if you're building APIs, a lot of times that kind of exploration is harder, right? If the API is just returning something, you could just put in the URL, and that probably works just as well in the browser. But many times, you're using the HTTP verbs that are tricky to make the browser do. For example, there might be a method that has a put, an HTTP put. How do you do an HTTP put in your browser? I don't know. I mean, you can technically go into the JavaScript section and start typing it, but you know, then that's not really working with your browser, right? So one of the things I wanted to talk about is sort of testing out your API, getting different use cases and scenarios going before you maybe have some kind of client written in a much more exploratory way, right? I'm developing it. I want to see if this works. I want to try that and kind of go back and forth, maybe even before I've solidified this into some kind of unit test, is to use something like Postman. So are you familiar with the Postman app?
Not really.
A Postman is super cool. So what Postman lets you do is it's all about calling APIs. So what you do is you get a little dashboard and you put in a URL, and there's a dropdown. It says get URL, but the dropdown, you pull it down and it says things like, you know, a huge list of HTTP verbs that probably would surprise many people to know there are that many there. Like, so get, put, post, delete, patch, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can expand out a little section of, well, what's going to be in your request? Instead of just sending a URL and a query string, you can actually say, well, I want to specify query parameters and maybe some auth stuff. And I want to put this value in the header, like this API key in the header. And I'm going to put maybe a JSON body into the body and so on. And then there's even automated testing scenarios and like scripting stuff you can set up to do so.
So is Postman a paid service or a tool?
It's paid, but it's also free. So it's like a freemium type of thing. You can get it for free and work with it, but then you can get like a team version that you pay for, like team sync features and higher level features and whatnot.
Okay, so this still seems like I have to deploy it first.
You've got to at least have it running locally as a test thing. So you don't have to put it, you could just put localhost in there and just click away. The other thing that I end up doing a lot is I kind of want to remember these are the basic things I'm doing. So if like I get a message from somebody who says, hey, I'm trying to use your web app, right? Or sorry, your mobile app. So for Talk Python Training, we have mobile apps that let people take courses. Like I'm trying to use this and I had this problem. I can just fire up Postman and it'll let you create these little collections and like libraries of API calls. So I can go over there and like say, okay, what I want to do is I want to try to call this function, this API endpoint with this header. And it says it's this version of the application on this platform. So it behaves potentially differently. And I can just have those little things and just drop in there and just go, oh, well, let me just try that API endpoint real quickly. Push the button. It's already got the right JSON body saved as the input data for my little scenario I want to play with and whatnot. So it's a real cool way to like diagnose stuff quickly. I can jump in like, okay, this is how this part's supposed to work. And I don't have to fire up the app and all that. I can just make sure it's working.
And do you do that against the live version at that point then?
So, probably. Sometimes, okay. Not always. It depends. If it makes some kind of change, it might be I wouldn't do it against the live one on behalf of someone else. But a lot of times it's like, I'm just trying to log into this thing and get this data and it's not returning what I expected or whatever. So you could just go play with that. Yeah.
Neat.
So it lets you create these cool little libraries. So that's the first thing I want to just throw out there is if you're interacting with APIs, you know, something like Postman, I have the little desktop app, but I think there's a web browser version as well. The one thing to be aware of, I've had people say, well, I didn't want to install the app. So I just went and logged into the website and I did some stuff. The security around what you can do on the web one is stricter. Like you can do less. So for example, some sites don't allow you to call JavaScript methods from outside the domain and stuff like that, cross-site scripting protections and whatnot. There's no restriction like that in the desktop app, but in the website, you are of course in a web app, which has more restrictions. So just heads up on that.
Okay.
So let me give you another scenario. This is something that it's so, so simple. And yet it delights me so much when I see this in action. I'll start with like the more benign example. If I'm developing a web app and I've come up with a new page, like, oh, here's the admin page I'm building that allows us to do, you know, XYZ. And I want to share that with the team. Like I'm thinking about committing it back, but I want to have a conversation with a couple of my team members about how it works. Maybe my manager. How do you do that? Right. If you don't want them to completely set up maybe a change to the database and all that stuff locally, it can be kind of a pain to say, just run that and quickly give me some feedback. Or what do you guys think at this stand-up meeting? Here's what I did yesterday, but I got stuck on this. Can anybody give me some ideas?
Yeah.
So one thing you can do is you could do screen sharing and let everyone see it, but then they all have to be present at the same time. That's kind of annoying. So you could let them connect directly to your local machine through their web browser and actually just try out that page. And that would be awesome, except for router firewalls, NAT routing, machine firewalls, your local web server probably listens on localhost and it doesn't even let you have connections from the outside world, hopefully, right? Because of the internet is an evil place, right? All that. So what you can do is use something called ngrok. Are you familiar with ngrok?
Well, I've heard you talk about it a few times on the show.
So ngrok is super neat. So what it does is it's a service that it's like a public web server. So I could go and install it and just go to the command line and type ngrok space HTTP space 5000, something like that, right?
Okay.
Let me just type it in real quick so I can give you even more detail. So what it does is it will come up with an HTTP and an HTTPS public URL that you can use, but then it uses SSH tunnels from your local machine back to their server. So if you give that URL to somebody, they do a request, it goes to ngrok. Ngrok uses an SSH tunnel to talk to your local dev machine and send that back out. So you basically, regardless of firewalls, you can put APIs, you can put websites and whatnot temporarily on the internet, or even permanently, I guess, if we just left it running. But, you know, it's not really, I don't think, intended for that. And it's super cool. So what you could do is just say, hey, everyone, here's the URL. Click on this page and tell me what you think. And it's literally your exact version running there. You don't have to try to get like some database migration set up in a staging environment or some weird thing like that. So that's kind of the simple case. But then you get to the more interesting use cases.
Well, wait a second. I'm a little concerned about this. Is there security problems with me opening up a basically a web service on my laptop or something?
Well, basically, the whatever service you're exposing, you should just assume that it is on the internet, right? Because it doesn't have any authentication generally. Okay. On top of that, it's some random URL with a huge long UUID type thing. So it's not likely people are just going to start jumping on it right away. But at the same time, you know, people could request it. So you'd want to.
And you've probably got some silly like mock database or something running.
Yeah, ideally. I mean, that's a good point. Or you could have actual authentication in your application that just happens to also kick in locally, maybe, right? So, but you do want to think about that. That is definitely something. And that's interesting. Like, that's kind of we didn't want to do screen sharing. So cool, you can actually check out the thing live on your local computer because it does interesting animations or whatever. But then it goes beyond that. So one example, I was talking about the TalkPython training web apps. Well, they've got a talk.api. And when we were developing the TalkPython apps, I was working with another guy who is more of an iOS developer and a mobile developer. But I was building the API side. He was building the app side. And we needed to coordinate. Every now and then, there'd be some kind of error. It's like, I'm really trying to do this thing with the API, and it's not working. I'm like, oh, man. All right, well, let's try this and then try that. And it's, you know, you can look at the logs on the server and stuff, and it's just not all that helpful. So what we did is said, well, let's run an ngrok session and go to the mobile app and change it to say that the API endpoint is that ngrok destination, not training.talkpython.fm/API, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then I would just set a breakpoint in PyCharm. I'd say, okay, go click the button that was causing the problem. He'd click it. It would hit a break. He was in like Europe. Would hit a breakpoint on my machine in America. I would look at the values and I step through. I'm like, oh, you're passing that as a string that has to be a number. It's like quote 4 instead of the number 4. That was a problem. And then he would fix it. And how awesome is that exchange?
Yeah. So you've just got it. He's debugging it in his app. And
right. He's debugging the mobile side. I'm debugging the API endpoint side. And we're like stepping through it on both ends.
Nice.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's really cool. And then the third one is I was doing some stuff with Twilio, and Twilio Studio has this really cool workflow designer that says, if a message comes in, ask them this. And then if they say that, you can do this other thing. And one of the steps is I need to call this endpoint to decide what options I have to give them. And that was coming from this app, this Flask app I was working on.
Yeah.
Same thing. Create an ngrok URL, put it into the Twilio cloud, send a message with WhatsApp. It makes it to that step, and then it hits a breakpoint back on my local machine as I'm developing it before it's ready for production.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So this one just delights me to no end. I mean, it's a super simple idea, but it's really well done.
And then you're really just, I mean, there's not a lot of security risk there because you're going to tear down the ngrok session afterwards, right? So
yeah, exactly. It lasts for a few minutes, and it wasn't really sensitive data.
Yeah. Okay. That's neat. How about things like Fast API and other things have this interactive mode? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So with Fast API, you can, so if your app is at server.com, you can go to server.com/docs, D-O-C-S, and it pulls up an API, an open API documentation spec that shows you all the endpoints. And then you can go in there and test it. But that would be sort of equivalent to Postman.
Okay.
Right. And you could do that with, like, you could go in there and type that in. But the problem is, if you're done testing it, you put away your browser and walk away. Or if you've got three scenarios to test for one endpoint, you've typed one in and the other two are gone.
Yeah.
Well, okay. You want to go back and you're like, oh, I also want to pass this header. And I want to say that my user agent is this versus that. Or like, there's just,
So it's more manual. So
it's more manual and it's not permanent. Like, so with Postman, it'll record like, here's a history of all the requests you've sent, and here's the ones that you've saved to your catalog, even though there could be three that go to the same URL, but this one's anonymous, that one's logged in. And it's just, you could do the same thing, but you've got to like redo it from typing it. It's like working in the REPL versus working in a Python file. Like, you could do it in the REPL, but you wouldn't want to do it very long in the REPL or very many times.
And this is something we actually haven't explored too much on this show before, on this podcast, is that there's fully automated tests, there's fully manual testing, and then there's this in-between thing of using automation to help you do sort of exploratory manual poking and being able to save things. Sounds like Postman falls into this middle category.
Right. So much of the stuff I wanted to cover was like that middle ground, because I feel like it doesn't get talked about a lot.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so one of the things that is a simple thing that you brought up before the show was this idea of like testing your sitemap. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is definitely, if you were to think of like the pure TDD world of type of testing, this would probably get you bad looks. They'd be like, oh, that, come on, Michael, nah, right? But you would get some of that. But at the same time, what have I told you? You could test like the majority of your app really, really easily and get kind of a, does it catch on fire and explode, or does it mostly sort of work before you start answering precise questions like, if I pass this data over, do I actually get the right location back? You know, like proper unit tests, right? So one of the things that you can leverage is a real simple idea. What if I were to request every page on my site? And determine, does that page load without crashing, or does it 500 server error or 404 not found error, something like that, right? And it sounds really simple, but if you actually think about the ways that many websites break, they don't break like, oh, well, that little image is now hidden, or there's no data in this table. They crash like, wham, you know, could not load this thing. This syntax is broken. This model doesn't match the tables anymore. Like they break hard most of the time. And what that means when they break hard, that means, you know, the page serves up a 500 error, right?
Yeah.
Or it's just not found and it's a 404. So what if you just requested every page on your site as one of your tests? This is more of an integration test side of things, but it's a really quick way to just go, let me try this and make sure things are still alive. And okay, great. Well, how are you going to do that? Maybe for a small site, super easy. The TalkPython training site has like 4,000 pages. That's a lot of pages to request, right? How would you know what page to request? Well, almost all of our sites have sitemaps at /sitemap.xml because we want to give that to Google and increase our SEO, right? Like one of the key things to getting your site well-ranked in Google is having a sitemap that says, hey, Google, here's every page that I would like you to pay attention to, even if you don't find a link to it, right?
Okay.
Well, here's the test. Request the sitemap. Parse the XML for each URL, request it, response dot assert, raise for unexpected or whatever that one function is that raises an error if it's not a 200 or a 201 or a 302.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So anyway, that's my little tip trick to sort of do a quick catch-all against maybe those pages that don't have tests or parts of the sites that you forgot to write tests for. Kind of an integration test more than anything, but an easy one.
And this is also, I mean, I actually love this idea. Even if you're in a real hurry, and like, for instance, if I'm doing a migration from one domain to another or to a subdomain or something like that, I can easily grab this sitemap, save it somewhere, maybe do a search and replace to change the domain or change the subdomain.
Yep.
And then, bam, I can use that as a test to when I finally get there to make sure everything's still there.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a big hammer that probably will fail until you get it right. But it's also like really easy to generate. So
yeah, it's super easy. It's probably like 20 lines of code and you've tested, you know, you're near 100% code coverage in a really, really crappy, wonky way. That's fully more integration style because it's probably going to talk to the database and whatever it's going to do. But at the same time, you know, imagine you are hired as a consultant, like, hey, Brian, I need you to come work on this project. And yeah, this is kind of a crummy site. We don't have tests here. Please make it a little bit better and add this other feature, right? If you were given some piece of code, some website that was fairly complex and it didn't have those tests and you didn't have that much time, here's something you could put in place to like go, okay, here's a little tiny safety net as I tweak on it. And you want all this stuff for SEO anyway, right? So you probably have it there. Just might as well leverage it.
Yeah. Well, so, okay. So that's the easy one, or semi-easy.
Yeah. It's semi-easy for sure.
But that is one of those, your site's up or your service is up and you're making sure it stays that way. I'm occasionally going to do maintenance on my application. What do I need to do to keep it alive?
Well, one of the things that I think is really empowering about having proper unit tests, about having continuous integration, if you're working on a team or at least having some local tests you can run yourself, like this sitemap thing, before you send it up to make sure it's kind of hanging together. And also having some simple way to deploy your site. There's deployment, such a spectrum of things, but a lot of times I'll go to places and I just can't even fathom what is happening at this team behind the scenes when they say, we're scheduling some upgrades, so we're going to be down for 4 hours and then we'll be back. Here's our notice. You're like, what do you mean you're going to be down for 4 hours? Like, this is the internet. I don't even understand. It's not like you're on vacation. What is happening, right? Like, how could it possibly take 4 hours to do whatever you're going to do? And so one of the things that I've ended up doing on my site is setting up a bunch of scripts that do various things. So for example, this also applies to Python Bytes, the server as well, but we've got some servers in DigitalOcean running on Ubuntu. And for the servers, they've got the main version, but they've also got like a smaller, cheaper $5 server that is, well, if I have to say reboot the main server for, you know, because the Linux kernel's got a security problem and it just has to be rebooted to fix it, we can flip the IP address within the cloud hosting over to the failover server. And it might be a tiny bit slower, but it's fine, right? And it's $5 a month. Who cares? Just let it run there and do its thing. So I've got a script that'll do something like that, right? So I can say, switch from the main production over the other and reboot it and do work on the machine and whatnot in case it, you know, like I said, needs a kernel patch or something. So that's nice. Also,
That sounds complicated, but...
It's actually super, super easy.
Okay.
There's like an API for saying, where's the public API assigned to which server? You can just like, it's like 15 lines of Python. It's not bad. Okay. That might be less, actually. It's a script that just calls into the Python, right? So that's all well and good. You might want to do something like that. If you're working on Heroku, right, they'll do that automatically. If you're working in Kubernetes, they'll do that automatically. That's part of the spectrum. If you're working in a place that doesn't let you do that, then you might just have downtime. I don't know. But then you can start to put these building blocks together like, oh, you know those that webhook idea or the ngrok idea I told you about. Well, when you check into Git, you can go and set the webhook to call back, right? So any commit that happens on GitHub, you can say, for this repository, call this other place, and you can check that out with ngrok and program against it and whatnot. So added a little thing that says, if there's a commit to a certain branch and it's changed a Python file, not just a text file or some other random thing, redeploy the website, which means use that little script to switch it over, tell it to restart itself. It actually does a bunch of other things. So it starts pre-warmed. Like a lot of times what can happen is certain pages are complicated to load up the first time, then the caching is in place and whatnot. So it'll do all that stuff before it brings it back online.
Okay.
So now I've got a little script on my computer working in PyCharm. Just go to the terminal, type prod, P-R-O-D. It'll switch branches, push all the changes up to the one branch, that'll fire the GitHub webhook, which will bring the thing over, which will switch it over to the failover server, which will refresh it. So there's just all these like little steps that you can take. And in the end, you end up with stuff where it's like, oh, I just typed this word. And then with zero downtime, we have a new version up in 1 minute.
Oh, that's right. Neat.
So there's a lot of neat little building blocks that are like, well, you know, sort of utilities that are useful for you. But if you piece some of these ideas together, then you end up with a cool thing. You don't have to put messages like, please don't come back on Sunday because we're updating the site.
Have you ever forgotten to switch away from your failover server and just left it on the slow one for a while?
You know, I think I have once or twice, not very often. I have this little dashboard thing that has a bunch of boxes. And it'll say, like, what's the response time of the site? How many users have logged in today? How many videos have been watched? What was the last one? And so on, like all those kinds of things. And one of them is, what deployment mode are you in, production or failover?
Okay.
And I went over there, wait a minute, that says failover. It's been that way for a couple of days. It's good enough. It's just not, you know, you wouldn't want like a huge burst of traffic on a $5 server, but still it's okay.
Okay. Nice. But sometimes this goes wrong and it doesn't all work, right?
Yeah. One of the challenges that we run into is if you've got to update the database server. Like, we don't have like clusters of databases. So like there's a very small amount of downtime for that. And you also just want to know, like, for example, one of the things that happened one time was, you know, I talked about this little IP address. It's the public IP address. In DigitalOcean, it's called the floating IP. And it can be assigned to one machine or the other machine. Well, one thing that has happened that is so hard to test, I don't know of very many tests on the machine that I would really know how to do this, because the machine is its own contained thing. It has its own IP address, but then there's this sort of virtual IP address back to itself, right? One thing that happened is there was a problem with the API at the cloud level, the cloud hosting level, where that became disassociated with either of the servers. And both servers, they thought they were fine because they were both running and doing their thing. And they asked, how am I doing? Like, I'm fine. But from the outside, nobody could get to it because the DNS records, you know, like, where is this domain go, was to the public IP address. Oh. And it didn't make its way through the networking stack at DigitalOcean. I'm just like, how was I supposed to know that this was a problem? Well, you got to have cake.
Cake.
You got to have cake. Status cake. So I set up status cake at statuscake.com, which is pretty cool. And another option might be better uptime. I just happened to have set this up with status cake when the problem was there. And I think better uptime actually looks a little bit better. Well, I mean, they claim it in the name, but anyway. The idea is you can just set up services that will call certain things. So like status cake, I've got, I think, 5 or 6 different things that are continuously monitored. The homepage of training.talkpython.fm, the homepage of talkpython.fm, the homepage of pythonbytes.fm, but also the RSS feed of the two podcasts, because those are like the lifeblood of our podcast, right? The spice. Yeah. If the RSS doesn't flow, the MP3s don't flow, it's a problem. So I said, I want a specific alert that if anything happens to the RSS feed, let me know right now. And another one I did was against this training API. And what it does is it just does a couple of things like, hey, try to go get some pre-assigned user from the database. Try to go to the video server, let's say in Germany, and try to watch a video and just make sure that all those things still work. And then tell StatusCake, yeah, the API is okay. And then StatusCake calls that every 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it is. And if it ever doesn't work, it sends me a message and says, hey, can't watch a video in Germany. That might be something you want to pay attention to.
Well, okay. One of my questions. So we've got there's a whole bunch of like software as a services like Status Cake and Better Uptime and things that you can run against your service. What do you think something like this seems reasonable. One of the questions is, I've got a few questions around it. One of them is, does it affect your, it's obviously calling stuff and requesting stuff. Does it mess up your statistics for your download counts and things like that?
No, because it's not actually requesting any of the MP3s for the podcasts.
Oh, okay.
And for the video plays, it's doing it like at a lower level than the stuff that does analytical tracking. So I don't think so. It doesn't run any JavaScript, so it wouldn't count any like Google Analytics type stuff. We don't even have that, but... Yeah, if it did, it wouldn't do that. I think it would be okay. I mean, it is something worth thinking about, because if what you're having it do is triggering some kind of analytic record, like here's a redirect to my I don't know, to the sponsor, and I want to tell them how many times it was clicked. And like, oh, well, we're testing that. Sorry, you're really popular. I mean, maybe that's good. Maybe you want to tell them that. But no, yeah, it's okay. Worth considering, but it's not for me.
Yeah. And then you do things like crash monitoring and stuff also, right?
Yeah. And it's, oh, man. So I use Rollmar and Sentry. Okay. I had one and the other, and they both kind of are really similar, but they're not the same. And so it's like, I just left them both then because I get notifications from both. Yeah. So the idea is, if your website crashes, would you know about it? Because, you know, the message usually just goes back as some kind of server error to whoever requested it. And maybe they'll send you a message. Maybe they'll say, hey, I was trying to do this thing and it stopped working. Or maybe the reaction is, whoa, this site is unreliable. I don't want to log into it and create an account in it. I'm out of here. Right. And you just wouldn't know. So you probably want to know. What you can do is set up something like Rollbar or Sentry or both. They both have free levels and then paid levels if you want to capture more history, more errors and whatnot. And they capture insane amounts of data, right? So if somebody goes to a page and has a crash, it'll say they were on this browser. It was this server, like the production server or the failover server in the story I told you. It was this version of Python. It was this version of the web framework. Here's the call, the traceback. Here's the call stack. Here's the headers. Here's all the cookies they exchanged. And you can go further and you can actually go and, as part of the API, as a part of middleware in my website, I hook into these APIs and say, if there's a user session active, oh, hey, by the way, Sentry, the current user is so-and-so. So if there's a crash, it'll put in the email like, Joe Smith had a crash trying to watch this video on Tuesday on this on Windows with Firefox 86. And here was the query string. And more than once, I've had somebody who was trying to buy something, and there was a whole bunch of changes I made to the checkout flow for, I think, for Black Friday or something stupid. I was getting myself out over my skis. And anyway, I broke like the team checkout for a certain type of bundle. I think it's something really esoteric that I forgot to test, and it crashed. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like so bad. But luckily I had all this in there. And so I had the email address to the person. I'm so sorry this crashed. I saw you were trying to do this purchase earlier. We fixed it. And I just want to apologize and let you know it should be okay now. They're like, oh my gosh, I was going to write you later. This is so amazing. I can't believe you wrote me a message. Like, when was the last time you were on a website or an app and it crashed? And then they just contacted you and said, oh, sorry, you had a problem. I'm real sorry. We fixed that for you. Like, never, right?
No, yeah. No, I don't
and it's,
think so.
It's, I mean, you get an email that says, this user had this problem, right? And if you got the capacity to help them, like, it's relatively easy. These APIs are incredibly simple, and it's huge value.
That's pretty cool. And you may have gained a sale that you may have lost otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. They did come back and buy it. I don't know if they would have not otherwise, but certainly it worked out in the favor.
So something like if you're actually providing a service that you make money off of, something like this is definitely worth the whatever you're paying for it then.
Yeah, exactly. Especially since I'm paying nothing. Because oh, you get like 5,000 errors a month before you start to pay for it. And I mean, to be honest, if you're having more than 5,000 errors a month, you're having a problem, right? You really just need to like stop feature development and go, okay, why are we having 5,000 crashes a month? This is too many. Even if you have a lot of users, you should like log it, send them a proper response, not crash the server.
Well, maybe your testing strategy is deploy and pray.
Yeah. Yeah. User testing. Users.
We have beta testers. They're called customers.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cool. If you're running Sentry or Rollbar or something, crash reporting. Mm. Does that slow down your site?
Maybe, but in a very, very imperceivable way. So basically the way it works is when the web server, the web framework is making a bunch of, oh, it's processing. So I got this URL, I'm going to hand it over to the routing system. The routing system says, okay, that's going to go over to this view method. There's one other function call that's like between those two, like a decorator almost around them, right? Yeah. And what it does, it says, call the thing that's actually happening, accept, handle the error, send it off to wherever it goes, and then return the response. So it's basically a function call and a try accept. If there's no error, it's just the try block. So it's really light in terms of the overhead. No, it's not like re-instrumenting stuff or like it's nothing along those lines. It's basically just a one function decorator wrapper around a request.
And you were saying you used status cake. Does that tell you response times and stuff?
It does. It actually gives you a really cool graph over time of what your response time, you know, average response time of this is. And it'll do it from different locations. Like I think the free tier does 3 different servers around the world for each test. So it's not just your cert site is up at the edge of your cloud or whatever. It's like, we can get to it from India. We can get to it from North America. We can get to it from Europe.
And I know that, like, I don't know, it was some months ago you started looking at the speed of your site, of your empire, and and tried to speed things up. Why? What was it? Was some of these status things that caused you to do that, or did you just want to make sure it was faster?
No, there were 2 things that made me go down this path. One, we covered an article called 12 requests per second on Python Bytes, which made me think, well, that sounds, it's about Python frameworks. And it was about basically like, there's people that talk about all this amazing performance and my real web app gets 12 requests per second at the top end. Should I be happy or not? Basically, I'm like, what does mine do? So I wanted to answer the question of, well, what is the peak number of users I could have? It's had a lot of users from like Humble Bundle deals and whatnot, but you know, where was it crash? Like we've all had these experiences where, you know, it's something happened on a popular day and some site and like the site goes down. Can't remember the last one I had. It was some consumer thing I was trying to buy, but you know, the most egregious one of these has to be healthcare.gov or whatever that thing was, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd like to know, can my site handle 100 users? I don't know. 100 concurrent users requesting stuff. Is the infrastructure we set up good? Do we need to add a caching layer or is it just going to handle it just fine? So one of the things that I was using to answer that question was locust.io. And this is like a Python goodie for sure. And you and I talked about this on Python Bytes a little bit, but
yeah,
what a neat framework. So what it is you write, it allows you to do load testing of your site. There's lots of those. But it does it in a really interesting and Python-friendly way. So what you do is you create a class, and a class is a bunch of methods. Each method is a thing to do to your website, and it's very test-driven feel. So it has like a setup and a teardown type of thing.
Okay.
And the setup might be go to the login page and log in, because the next thing you're going to do, you want to make sure that the user is logged into the site, because that might require authentication to get to a certain part or something, right?
Yeah.
So you could do things like that kind of setup stuff, and then like tear down, I guess, could be log out or delete my account or something. Anyway, you would go set these different methods, and you'd say, on this one, I want you to request, like, let's talk about the podcast site, right? I want you to request the episode page where you see all the episodes. And then I want to have another method that's going to request the details about the podcast. And then I want to have another one that's going to request the RSS feed. And then another one that might try to download the MP3, and then one that goes to the homepage. Who knows?
Yeah.
And then you can actually say, well, 70% of the time, I want you to go to the episode page. 25% of the time, go to the episode list. You know, 5%, go and download the MP3. And you can also put in, as part of that setup, you can put in a timing. Like, well, the average user will click a link between 5 to 60 seconds on average per page, right? Because the average user isn't like obsessively just, you know, control F5 your site or command R your site like as hard as they can, right? They're going to a page, they look at it, and they go to the next. So you can just set that all up into a Python class, run Locust, and it opens up a web UI with graphs and errors and like real-time views of all of this stuff. So you just give it that file. Say you tell it this server, this many concurrent clients, this many connected users, go, and it'll tell you response time, number of errors. If you get error, you want to see the errors, you can log in and see the, or you go over and see the details. You get cool graphs of like performance over time. Like, does your response time degrade as, you know, when does it start to degrade as a number of users? So anyway, for me, I found that we could do about 125 to 135 absolute concurrent requests hammering on our server which with a little breakdown represented something like 20 to 40,000 users on the site at a time.
Okay.
Which, you know, for probably $60 in infrastructure, that felt like pretty good.
Yeah. And so since, I mean, conceptually you could run this against a test server or a.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, so much about the performance of Python web apps has to do, are you running in a production server or in a development server? Because a development server, there's just one thread, one process. But like in production, you're running MicroWSGI or GUnicorn with a bunch of workers spread out in like a multi-threading mode. Like the performance is really different. But yeah, you should definitely start on your machine and then think about, you know, branching out.
Right. But I mean, you could also do like have a test server that's almost yep. like your real server.
Exactly. That's a good yeah. idea. Because you don't necessarily want to take down the live website for everyone.
But on the other hand, one of the reasons why I like talking to you about this and not like a huge company is because you're like you're not just a DevOps kind of person. You're the CEO and the yeah. designer and
all the things, yeah.
From top to bottom, right? So...
I can do this stuff and not get in trouble. I could be regretful for it, but I'm not going to get in trouble for it. I can do these little experiments. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that I quote a lot is you had talked about something on our show together that was, you're not Facebook, you're not LinkedIn, you're not Google.
Yeah.
The way you'd build your site is not those things. And so much of these sort of like this advice and these kinds of things are like, well, here's how we're going to like set up continuous scale at, you know, such and such insane level. Well, you're probably not at that level. So how do you still get stuff done and make these decisions when you're at a less insane level?
Right. But it used to be that a single person company, or maybe I'm just wrong about this, but I guess when I had just had a little, little website or something, a WordPress site or something, that if I could build up some sort of revenue flow, but I would not do any of this extra stuff around it. Because I either didn't know how to, or it was expensive to run some yeah. sort of service. But now, like you said, some of these things they have a free tier and you can just run them for free to monitor yeah, your stuff.
Absolutely. I talked about it being $60 of infrastructure. That's a $40 database server and a $20 web server. But I'm pretty sure it would be actually totally good to go $10 on the web server, $10 on the database server. It just happens to be there's other stuff going on that I want to account for. There's nothing else in this whole conversation that I've paid any money for. I mean, that's $20 a month, right? It's incredible.
Yeah.
I remember in the early .com days, I'm guessing, what is this, 99, 2000, I went to this conference that was put on by, I think it was Oracle, Microsoft, and one other thing. They invited me over to this like setting up an e-commerce website. It's just so easy. We'll get it all set up for you. This predates a lot of the cloud computing, so they'd sell you the hardware and then the SSL load balancers and then all the things. And they're like, at the end, it was like, for just $100,000, you can have an e-commerce site. Like, it's just so insanely different than now, right?
Yeah.
It's so crazy. Also, it's worth pointing out, like, a lot of this stuff hasn't kind of been building up over, you know, 4 or 5 years, right? When it started out, it was much simpler. And then I'm like, this thing is kind of a pain point. How can we address that? It was down and I didn't notice it. How can we address that, right? All these things have been layered on slowly over time, but it's kind of like a look back.
Right. And they,
I wouldn't do this from day one. Like I would just get, you know, something working and then like slowly build towards it.
I like the idea of having something like crash reporting and stuff because I assume you can take a weekend off and not worry about stuff without like, if your livelihood depended on it, even if it's just your side gig and your vacation money depended on it, I've noticed that I check stuff. I like, oh, well, is it still working? And I'll go around and manually check things. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be doing that while you're on your weekend. So some monitoring is a good idea.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it definitely gives you that, you know, sort of comfort level, like, okay, I haven't got any alerts from any of the systems. Everything must be fine.
And I really, thanks for coming on. And I've also enjoyed, actually just coming along for the ride. I remember a lot of these changes. I remember you setting up just a simple site and then adding videos and the complication and the, with all of that. And I remember getting a message from you saying, like, I just am now deploying video from like three different locations on the earth. And
yeah, it's like 12 different video servers that it just automatically like replicates to. I've got it working on now. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah. And that's pretty cool. And yeah. When we were talking about the $60 thing, that's something I think about is like, not everybody is deploying and serving so much video content. You've got, since you're doing a lot of video content and you're serving that, that's a lot of bandwidth that most people aren't doing with their sites.
Yeah, it's totally, it would be probably a busy month, but it wouldn't be outrageous to say we had $1,000 bandwidth bill for the month.
Wow.
at AWS, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not now, right? I mean.
Yeah, that's yeah. Still now. Yeah.
Okay.
So all the other stuff, like, so this infrastructure, like that, I'm talking like servers and database servers and all that, but like to actually deliver the bandwidth, not the podcast. The podcast is for free, but the video stuff, because I want it like super close to people and the way it's set up. Yeah, it's like that. But it's okay. People are paying for it, so it's fine. If people don't consume a lot, that's mean they haven't bought a lot. But if they're consuming a lot, it means they've bought a lot of courses. So it scales perfectly with income, so it's fine.
Okay. That sounds terrifying to somebody making zero off of their content.
Yeah. But again, it starts with smaller numbers and it goes up, but you're like, okay, there are many alerts. There are many like tiers at AWS. Like if it goes over $50, send me a notice. If it's over $100, send me a notice. Like there's all these like billing bells that go off.
Okay. My heart's slowing down now again. So thanks.
Not mine, but it's okay. It's like a steady state.
This has been fun, and I'm sure I'd like to have people generate questions. So I'm sure this answered some questions and generated questions. So please reach out, and we could do a follow up of if we need to do some more questions. So thanks a lot, Michael, and we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and it's always great to be here, Brian.
Thank you for listening to Testing Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.